Welcome to Talking Energy, the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
Hello, I am your host Jessica Bayes, and in this episode we are talking about the rising price of gas. According to figures from Oil and Gas UK, the price of wholesale gas has surged by 250% since the beginning of the year, with a 70% increase in August alone. Due to these price increases, some industries were temporarily curtailed and a number of gas suppliers have gone bust, with potentially more following suit. To explore this issue, I'm joined today by Mike Bradshaw, who leads our research on the geopolitics of the energy system and is also Professor of Global Energy at Warwick Business School. So let's jump straight in. The government has said that protecting consumers is its primary focus and we have a price cap in place, though this will increase as of October. What's the likelihood of the cap being reviewed out of its twice a year cycle, thereby passing rising costs onto consumers?
Well, given that the current prices are at record highs, and if you look at the futures price, that is what people are going to pay to get contracts, you know, 2, 3, 4 months down the line, there doesn't seem to be any reduction in price likely in the near term. The recent increase in the cap doesn't cover the current increase in price, which has gone up something like 70% in the last couple of months. So inevitably, the price cap will have to be revisited, because we have at the moment a situation where the electricity and gas companies are having to buy electricity and gas at much higher prices than they can charge their consumers, and therefore they're losing money. So something's got to give. And as I say, I don't see this issue being quickly resolved.
Do you have any idea, guessing, how long it might carry on?
Well, it's not, you know, normally gas prices go up in the winter. Demand is higher for heating, and much depends on what's happening globally. This is a problem that is partly a result from the fact that our gas markets now are much more globally interconnected than they used to be. So, for example, if it's cold in Asia, all of the liquefied natural gas goes to Asia, and we don't have it in Europe. We have to rely on storage and Russia and Norway, and that pushes the price up. What we have now is an extreme situation where prices are high everywhere to varying degrees. But particularly high in Europe, and we are particularly vulnerable in the UK. So I can't see any immediate source of help. There are things that might change in terms of additional supply into Europe, perhaps from Russia. Norway's promised to produce more. Actually, what matters most is the weather. You know, if we have a very cold, prolonged winter, as we did last winter, which is where this problem started, then it's going to get very difficult.
At the time of recording, six energy suppliers have been reported as going bust, and it is very likely that more will follow suit. The government has said they won't be bailing out suppliers, and apparently energy suppliers often exit the market at this point in the year ahead of the renewables obligation certificate. So what's going on there?
Well, we've had a liberalisation of our energy supply market. You know, we used to have the big six, as it were. Now we've got, I think, something like 70 different companies playing in the oil and gas, sorry, not the oil and gas, the electricity and gas market, supplying us with our energy. The majority of those don't have access to their own supplies. They're playing the market. They're also not very big. They don't have very big balance sheets, and they're not big enough to actually hedge by buying oil and gas in advance. So some of the bigger companies will have bought gas for the winter back in June, July, when prices were still high, but not as high as they are now. So if you're a small company, you've got no alternative but to buy gas on the market at whatever that price is. And so they are particularly exposed. They haven't got deep pockets, and they simply go out of business.
So the big suppliers, do they have their own storage facilities?
Well, we've got very little storage facility in the UK. Less than 1%, if you look at official figures from the European Gas Infrastructure Organization, and what we have is short term storage, which tends to fill up and empty numerous times through the winter, playing the short term market with price increases. So most of them don't.
Despite the price increases, the government has stated that this is not a security of supply issue. We have diversity of supply and sufficient capacity to meet demand. Is this the case?
Well, this is the mantra that the government always says, that we have diversity of supply, which they mean we have a geographical diversity of supply. You know, we shouldn't forget that we're still producing about half the gas that we consume ourselves from the North Sea, but we're therefore reliant on half our supply. About another third comes from Norway. and the rest from as liquefied natural gas or through continental markets, through interconnectors. So yes, we have a diversity of supply, but we tend to have a kind of just-in-time approach to securing that supply. And I just mentioned we don't have a lot of storage, but we also don't have lots of long-term contracts that would guarantee supply, whatever the market conditions. So we know, just like those small utilities, we are also, as a country, reliant on market price to attract the gas that we need. So we can think about physical security of supply, having the sufficient infrastructure, the pipes and terminals and whatever, to bring the gas we need to the country. And we have that, no doubt. But equally, we can think about price security of supply, which is the willingness of consumers to pay a price that's going to attract the gas to the UK market. And that's what the problem is at the moment. Affordability is being stretched because we're having to pay a higher price to attract gas to the UK market because we're in competition with the rest of Europe when it comes to pipeline gas, and we're in a competition with the rest of the world when it comes to LNG.
10. Okay, so if the problem is not one of supply, why is the UK having to pay such high prices?
Well, as I mentioned, it's because of this global competition, if you like, that we don't, you know, we are actually highly reliant on gas in comparison to other countries in Europe. Gas obviously it's a major producer of our electricity, about 40% on average. It's used extensively in household heating and about 85% of houses have gas heating. And as we're finding out, it's also very important for our industry, both as a source of heat, but also as a feedstock. So for example, into the fertilizer industry. So we are particularly exposed to gas as a country. And that's being exacerbated by the fact that we've pretty much got rid of coal. You know, so I think in 2020, coal was less than 2% of power generation. And I think we only have 3 coal-fired power stations left. So we can't fall back on that. And we have been successful increasing the role of renewables in our power supply. About 20% now comes from wind, but that is intermittent. And one of the problems this year is we've had a record still summer, the lowest or the stillest summer since 1961, apparently. And therefore, we've been down on renewable power generation. So we've had to lean more on gas. So all of those things mean that we're much more exposed to what happens in global gas markets. And although we supply 50% of our own gas, we haven't got any storage and we have to play the market. Mm-hmm. And when the market is unusually tight and prices are exceptionally high, I think this equates to an oil price of about $150 a barrel.
As we all know, COVID has had a significant impact on supply chains as many industries were closed and people were forced to stay at home. How has this impacted the situation?
Well, I think it all starts with COVID, and this problem actually starts back in 2020 when we had the lockdowns across the world, and that led to a dramatic decline in gas demand and gas prices. And so the gas industry had to shut in production, and it also had to delay investment and delay maintenance. And of course, what has happened now is that as demand has recovered, the gas industry is being lent on to increase production, but it also needs to go back to that routine maintenance. And there have actually been technical outages, problems in the supply chain, both in places like Norway and Russia. And so all of that has made it difficult for the industry to ramp up production. I think global LNG supply is down about 5%. So as we've had a situation post the decline when, in spring 2020, prices were at record lows. Today, they're at record highs. It's been a real pendulum. There have been a whole series of other issues along the way which have impacted on the ability of the global gas industry to match supply with growing demand. So the root cause, a compounding factor, if you like, has been COVID. But then there's been, I would say, issues perhaps related to climate change in terms of extreme weather. Very high temperatures, very cold winters, low rainfall, for example, in Latin America. The hydroelectricity in Brazil has not been available, and they've had to import liquefied natural gas. So you can add up a whole set of issues post, starting with a lockdown and a fall in demand, which has led to a rebound and growing demand and the inability of the global industry to match supply with demand. And it's just resulting in very high prices. Mm.
So leading from that, changing weather patterns due to climate change could have a significant impact on UK energy prices.
It would be, as ever, it's very difficult to attach, you know, extreme weather events to climate change. But I think the evidence is growing that, you know, these extreme events are becoming more and more common. Extremely cold winters, hot summers. These obviously have impact on demand for energy, you know, and particularly on gas, because gas is a source of electricity in summer months when air conditioning drives demand. So Asian demand is spiked in part because of a very hot summer. You know, we tend not to think about these things, but, you know, one of the other factors that is part of this perfect storm has been the impact of Hurricane Ida in the United States, where the vast majority of the new LNG terminals are located in the Gulf of Mexico and were shut down for a while because of the impact there. And in the United States, we see very short-term but very wild spikes in electricity and gas costs due to extreme weather. So maybe, yes, there's a backstory here about more extreme weather conditions, and maybe a realization that this does feed through in terms of greater volatility in terms of electricity and gas.
For those of us who are unfamiliar with gas markets, can you explain a little bit about the distinction between gas and LNG?
We're really talking about a distinction between pipeline gas and LNG or liquefied natural gas. Okay, so the majority of gas is transported by pipeline. In fact, the majority of gas produced globally is consumed within the countries that produce it. But when it comes to exports, we have these long distance pipelines. So, for example, pipelines that come from Russia to Europe or from Russia to China. And there's a pipeline network across North America. It's generally cheaper to transport gas by pipeline. But there are gas fields which are, you know, kind of stranded geographically that can't be accessed by pipelines. And there are markets that are like that. So places like Japan, for example, have got no pipeline access to continental pipeline systems. And for about the last 50 years or so, we've developed this global liquefied natural gas industry. So you take the gas and in an LNG liquefaction plant, you cool it to minus 160 degrees, which reduces its volume 600 times, turning it into a liquid. And you can then put that liquid on a specialist tanker, an LNG tanker, and that mobilizes it. It can travel across oceans and supply distant markets in the way that pipelines can't. You know, so if you think about Europe has a developed pipeline system, and we have in the UK, we are connected into that. But also they have LNG terminals in coastal regions, and we've got three in the UK, which plug into this global LNG system, which is probably about 25% of traded gas at the moment, increasing all the while. Growing trade in LNG and a slowly reducing level of pipeline gas trade.
There's been a fair bit in the news recently about the controversial Russian pipeline Nord Stream 2, with some headlines suggesting Russia is weaponizing energy supplies to Europe. What's your take on the situation?
As ever with Russia, it's a difficult one. Russia bore the brunt of the collapse in demand in the spring of 2020. And dramatically reduced its supplies into Europe to sustain the market and allow LNG to come to Europe. So we fast forward to where we are now. There are various conspiracy theories out there that would suggest that, you know, Vladimir Putin's deliberately got his foot on the pipe to constrain gas supplies to Europe. And if you look at it on face, you'd say that, you know, here is an opportunity where Russia could supply a lot more gas to Europe and make lots of money. But there are complications on the Russian side, not least of which, you know, that they've had technical problems in trying to increase production, having cut it considerably last year. And they have to prioritize filling up their own storage, which is empty after a very cold winter. But undoubtedly, there are signs that, you know, there could be geopolitics playing a role here. Gazprom has fulfilled all its contractual obligations to supply gas to Europe. Compared to last year, gas supplies are probably up. But actually, if you look at the geography, what you're seeing is more gas is going into Turkey, if you consider that part of Europe, because they've opened a new pipeline there, TurkStream. And there's no evidence really of massive new flows of gas into Central Europe. So why might Gazprom and the Kremlin be doing this? Well, it comes back to Nord Stream 2, which is the construction of a pipeline from Russia through the Baltic to Germany, a second pipeline in the same corridor as the imaginatively named Nord Stream 1. So What, you know, and this has been highly controversial. You know, people are divided within Europe over the wisdom of doing this because it would increase our a reliance on Russian gas. Well, it doesn't actually mean any more Russian gas. It just means that gas is coming from different directions. It's coming through Turk Stream in the south and Blue Stream, which is also to Turkey, and then Nord Stream 1 and 2 in the north, cutting out the transit states in Central Europe and also not using Ukraine as a transit country, even though Gazprom has a new agreement with Ukraine. So those in Central Europe don't like it because they feel they're being bypassed. It's also something that Washington has not approved of, and the Trump administration slapped sanctions on it to try and stop it. And Trump promised freedom LNG. We can talk a bit more about that later. Why hasn't that come? And so it's highly controversial. It's just finished construction and is waiting on approval by the German government. So it may be that Russia is trying to make a point about the importance of Russian gas to Europe. There are 30% of our gas supply comes from Russia. But also, there have been statements from the Kremlin to suggest that if Nord Stream 2 was quickly approved, then gas markets might rebalance in Europe. There's a limit to how quickly gas could flow through Nord Stream 2 for technical reasons, but that does suggest there's an element of holding back on supply to make a point. As a Russian colleague pointed out, Gazprom is not expressing goodwill at the moment. I mean, generally in a gas emergency, people try to help each other out. Gazprom at the moment is not doing that. It's a dangerous game because it may be a further blow to trying to maintain a role for gas in Europe's energy transition.
So getting into the details of that a bit, I read a joint announcement by the US and Germany. I think this is where the weaponization of the energy statement came from. But you said that Germany has not yet approved the pipeline. What's the delay in approving Nord Stream?
Well, it's not a delay. It's only just been finished construction.
Okay.
So it needs to go through an approvals process that will take time.
Yeah.
And I guess the suggestion is that, you know, they should expedite the approval process. But this isn't, as I say, this is not about new gas. It's about relocating the way in which gas comes to Europe to Gazprom's advantage financially, because they're shorter routes and they don't have to go through transit countries. So there are real economic reasons why it works for Gazprom, and Germany agreed to it. So it's this idea that if we approve Nord Stream 2, then more Russian gas might flow, and that might ease the situation.
You previously mentioned the interestingly named Freedom LNG from America. Can you say a bit more about
prior to COVID, the global gas industry was significantly oversupplied. There was a gas glut. And one of the reasons for that was the consequence of the shale gas revolution in the United States. And the United States has, you know, the industry in the United States has built is building still a number of LNG export terminals to export shale gas into the market. And this was having an impact on the global gas market. And in the Trump administration, you know, in discussing Nord Stream 2 and Europe's reliance on Russia, sort of touted the idea of LNG exports from the United States as being Freedom LNG. And I think there was an agreement by the head of the European Commission and Donald Trump that United States would flow LNG to Europe. And at the time, it was pointed out that it was not in the gift of either of those to do that. It was really down to market forces. And if prices were high enough in Europe, then gas would flow to Europe. But at the moment, it's not flowing to Europe for reasons which are quite straightforward. The gas price in Asia for LNG is higher, and there are also contractual obligations that require them to send gas to Asia.
Does that mean people in Asia are happier to pay higher prices than those in the UK?
They've made a decision over the longer term that prioritises energy security over getting the cheapest gas, if you like. Because and it starts with the way in which Japan, which was the originator of the LNG supply chain in terms of demand in Asia, has paid for LNG, which is through long-term contracts which are indexed to the oil price. And this gives, you know, both the producer and the consumer some sense of security, although there is a degree of price risk relative to the oil price. But the point is that the majority of the supply going into Asia is on long-term oil index contracts. So at the moment, they are paying lower prices because of that. There is an element that is on the spot market in Asia, and those prices are extremely high. So essentially, the way that Asia has dealt with it is to pay a premium on security of supply through these long-term contracts, which works in tight markets, but may not be such a good deal when there's surplus supply and they may find themselves and oil prices.
So some countries in Asia have long-term contracts, but you mentioned previously that the UK has an issue with just-in-time deliveries. Can you explain a bit more about
that? Well, it's partly because of the role that Europe plays in the global LNG industry, which is a kind of a balancing market. You know, so it's really a question of how to balance the global supply given demand in Asia. So if demand in Asia is low and there is surplus LNG, it will tend to go to Europe. And Europe has that flexibility because Europe's got a lot of storage, but also because it has, you know, its pipeline supplies can be moderated, as it were, and that's driven by price signals now. So if the price goes down in Europe. And so what has traditionally tended to happen is that Asian demand in summer has been relatively low and LNG has flowed to Europe to fill up summer storage. And that's one of the things that hasn't happened. Now, the UK doesn't, as far as we can ascertain, and we're doing a piece of research to get at UKIRK together with the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, looking at the role of LNG in UK and gas security, so it's quite timely. One thing we found out is it's very, very complicated. We've got three LNG terminals in the UK, one at the Isle of Grain, which is owned by National Grid, which sells the capacity to other companies to use. And two in Milford Haven, one owned by Qatar Petroleum, Southwark Gas, and one which is owned by Shell and an infrastructure company, but the capacity is held by Petronas, called Dragon LNG. And they all operate differently. And we've been trying to understand what's going on there. But what does seem to be the case is that there's very limited firm long-term contract trade for LNG. We found one contract which Centrica holds with Qatar Petroleum. But even then, although there's a supply agreement, many of these supply agreements have clauses in them that means if the price is higher elsewhere, the gas can be diverted. We also don't seem to have a clear commitment, certainly in the public domain, that Qatar Petroleum will supply a given amount of gas through Southwook to the UK. And I've no doubt that, you know, there are British diplomats busy in Doha asking for, you know, some LNG cargoes, please. It takes 2 weeks to get here, but, you know, if we could fill up the tanks at Southwood Gas, that would help significantly. So because we don't have a lot of firm contracts, hardly any, and it may be the case that we have no guarantee of LNG supply, the companies that hold the capacity trade the spot market. And that means that we, you know, and the further complication is that we have our own gas price, the national balancing point. And that is the price that LNG has to be sold for once it arrives in the UK. So if the national balancing point is not sufficiently high, it won't attract LNG cargoes. There are other complications as well. But the bottom line we've been hearing from capacity holders and traders is that the UK is not an attractive location for LNG. And it's regarded kind of as a dumping ground of last resort. That is not going to guarantee you supply of LNG in a tight market.
So if the UK is struggling to attract gas at a reasonable price, can't we just ramp up production of domestic gas from the UK continent?
Well, here we feed into another ongoing debate, don't we, about whether, you know, continuing to develop the North Sea is compatible with our net zero targets. But more generally, actually, gas production from the North Sea has plateaued in recent years, although in the first quarter of this year, due to those maintenance issues we talked about earlier, it had fallen quite, you know, 10% or so. But this is a gas basin that is in decline. It's well past its peak. And if you look at the projections from the Oil and Gas Authority, the, you know, gas production from the UK basin is going to continue to decline. How quickly depends on how much investment can be attracted. And the level of import dependence, of course, depends on how much gas demand remains in the UK. And that's another huge uncertainty. So production from the North Sea will continue to decline, just how quickly we don't know. And of course, the industry is making a case at the moment, as it would, that, you know, this shows a need to invest in maintaining production to slow the rate of, but of course, there are others who'd say we should not be investing in the offshore oil and gas because it's not compatible with net zero. It's quite clear we're not going to have any shale gas production in the UK. We do have biogas, but that's a small part. And there's a limited amount of onshore natural gas as well. So the reality is that, you know, unless we rapidly reduce the level of demand in the UK, importing dependence is going to.
As part of your work at UKIRC, your team have been looking at the implications of Brexit on the energy system. And it is clear from this conversation that international relations and smooth trading are key to keeping prices down. What impact do you think Brexit has had and will have going?
I think the short answer is, so far, no impact. But we will see this winter. The fact is that we are still physically integrated into a European gas and electricity market through interconnectors. And therefore, you know, and we are trading back and forth gas and electricity with members of the European Union. So although we're physically part of a European market, we are not part of the single energy market anymore. We're outside of the European single energy market, the gas market and the electricity market. Although we are still abiding by their rules, because it's early days and we simply transferred all of the EU rules into our own rules and regulations. And so far, there's been little or no impact on flow. There have been technical problems. So there was a fire in Kent that's damaged one of the electricity interconnectors to France. But our gas interconnectors are flowing, and we export gas as well as import gas from Europe. And we shouldn't forget also that the Republic of Ireland is at the end of a very long pipe because we supply a large share of their gas. So they're getting hit the same way that we are at the moment because they're reliant on our gas supply. I think there's two things to consider going forward. One is that the European Union's energy union legislation has the notion of a solidarity mechanism, which suggests that when there are problems of physical supply, EU member states should help their neighbours out to ensure that households do not get impacted upon. So if we did get into a situation this winter where there was a physical shortage of supply of gas in continental Europe and the solidarity mechanism was evoked, we're not clear what that means for supplies of gas coming from the European Union to the UK. But the other problem there, of course, is Ireland, is that, you know, they are a member state. And if they stop supplying the UK, they are sort of de facto stopping the supply to the Republic of Ireland. So we must see how the solidarity mechanism unfolds. I suspect that if there is a gas emergency, there won't be that much solidarity among member states. The other factor, I think, and it comes back to Russia, is to reflect on the fact that we are kind of held hostage now to the success or failure of the EU's energy diplomacy with Russia. Because although we don't get a lot of gas directly from Russia, the price on the Northwest European gas market hubs impacts on our own price. You know, so if there was a falling out and gas prices went up in Europe, it would automatically impact on our own gas price. So if things do get difficult, we will find out what not being a member state means. I'm going to say it's interesting to note that I think in Parliament yesterday, the energy minister said that the UK supports Nord Stream 2. And of course it does, because what the UK wants to see is a well-supplied Northwest European gas market, which means that the gas price in Europe is low and we can get supplies when we.
So it sounds like we might find quite a lot over the winter in terms of how things will play out. With the government committing to meeting net zero and a ban on gas boilers in new build homes post 2025, what role do you see for gas as we transition to net zero?
Well, this is a key uncertainty, and it's something I've written about more than once in terms of in the UKIRC Energy Policy Review, is that, you know, there is no certainty around the future role of gas in the UK energy system. And it's already changed quite significantly, that gas has becoming a firm backup to intermittent renewable power generation. But gas remains a critical source of interseasonal storage and providing, you know, massive amounts of energy for winter heating. At the moment, we can't replace that with renewables. I think the problem is, if you look at the different scenarios for what happens to gas in the UK's energy transition, it's going to decline, and a rate of decline depends on the scenario. There are scenarios, particularly for blue hydrogen, which uses gas as a feedstock that keeps more gas in the mix. But there's more of an electrification renewables path that would actually see no gas demand by 2050. So the issue really is, how do we get from the system we have today, where we have had a rude awakening as to how critical gas is, not just in power and heat, but also as a feedstock in industry, to a system in 2050 where there is little or no unabated gas and very low gas demand. So how do we need a strategy, which is what I've called gas by design, that takes the infrastructure and industry with us for as long as we need it and it ensures a just transition where to a situation where we don't rely on the gas system we have today. And I simply don't see that blueprint. The government white paper acknowledged the role of gas, 40% of energy, but said there would be a consultation. So at the moment, we don't have gas by design and we're paying the price of gas.
And in the near term, what do you think should be done to remedy the current crisis and ensure that this doesn't happen again next?
This comes back to our previous conversation that, you know, if this is what we might call, say, a sunset industry, that the aim of our energy policy is to reduce our reliance on gas longer term. And of course, the renewables sector is saying we need to generate more and more by renewables and get off gas. Doesn't make much sense, really, investing in new infrastructure now that you're going to no longer need 10, 20 years down the line. These are large scale, long term investments. But I do think that the issue of storage needs to be looked at. The government decided not to intervene in the market back in 2018. But their blue hydrogen strategy will require more gas, and it may require hydrogen storage. So we do need to look at storage if hydrogen is going to replace gas, giving us that interseasonal energy. I would think also we perhaps need to look at the way we are using our existing LNG infrastructure. But again, it may be a question of incentivizing capacity holders to hold gas. That does mean more state intervention in paying for greater resilience than we have at the moment, because we have been wholly reliant on playing the market. And you know, whether it's ideologically acceptable for the current government to intervene to create more resilience, we have far less storage than most countries in continental Europe, and particularly those who use a lot of gas have a lot of storage. When the UK revisited this issue in 2018, it did point to the fact that we could access that storage in Europe. I don't know that we can, and we'll find out this winter if we can. So I think as part of the kind of gas by design, we need to understand that actually what's happening now is partly a reflection of the uncertainty generated by the energy transition, which is inevitable and necessary, but it is placing much greater demand on the gas industry in terms of resilience and flexibility. And we just can't assume it's there when we need it at prices we're willing to pay.
That was UKIRK co-director Professor Mike Bradshaw on the many complexities that surround the supply and price of gas.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKIRK, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.